Yeah, nice to see you all again. It's funny, already since last night, I already feel that I know you so much better than just 24 hours ago standing up here. It does feel like, I think Jnanavacha said, that we've come together as a retreat really quickly, actually. I really appreciate that. Okay, so I'm going to be hopefully talking about meeting the Buddha. The theme of this retreat, meeting the Buddha, and what does that mean? And I thought I'd start, this is where my own thoughts started, with thinking not about the word Buddha, but about the word meeting, actually. I thought, it's interesting that our sort of instinct was to call this retreat meeting the Buddha, rather than say learning about the Buddha or studying the Buddha. So it's meeting the Buddha. So, it's quite a particular word. Suggests an encounter, a sort of mutual exchange. And as I was thinking about this more and more, actually, I started to realise it was meeting the Buddha was a more mysterious thing than I than first kind of might meet the eye. The title seems quite simple, doesn't it? Almost about throwaway, meeting the Buddha. And I was talking to Jnanavacha this morning in our little meeting that we have every morning on the retreat. And I was saying to him, Jnanavacha, I said, the more I think about it, the more I wonder if you could actually only meet the Buddha if you were a Buddha, or if you were another, at least another enlightened being yourself. The Buddha's an enlightened being, but he's got a very special place. He's called the Buddha because he was said to be the first in our era to have attained enlightenment, the Buddha, although there have been other enlightened beings following. And so, I was thinking about this. I thought, I think you'd have to be enlightened to sort of to meet the Buddha, to know who you were meeting, to fully meet the Buddha. And Jnanavacha said an interesting thing, because he said, yes. First of all, he said yes. And then he said, either that, or else you'd become enlightened in the encounter. And I thought, that's interesting. I think that's the key to it, that transformation would happen in the encounter. And then I thought, I think that's the key to any real meeting, any real encounter is one where transformation happens within it. And I thought, we can probably all think of examples of that in our own life, on maybe a more ordinary level, encounters that have transformed us. And I was thinking, the encounter itself might seem quite small, and maybe we'll only know it by the effect of it. And I was just thinking in my own life, and I was going back to that time that Jnanavacha described where I very first encountered Buddhism. And I encountered it through a person, my first meditation teacher. I'd gone along to learn to meditate, not particularly interested in Buddhism. And I went along to a class. It wasn't even at the London Buddhist Centre, although I ended up there. It was a kind of annex we had, so it wasn't particularly a Buddhist centre. It was in a rented room. And I met my first meditation teacher, and he had a very big effect on me. But what had the big effect wasn't so much the meditation itself, and it wasn't even kind of any words of wisdom that he said. It was what happened on the second week when I met him. So I said hello to him the first week. I was really shy, back then. And the next week I came back and he just looked at me and he said, "How are you this week?" And I thought, he really means that. And I actually thought, it was the first time in my life that somebody had asked me, "How are you?" And they really meant it, really, really meant it. I thought, he really cares how I am. It's not just a kind of how are you kind of that you say. And actually that was that was the beginning of Buddhism transforming me. That was that's very simple. You could say almost something you could almost have missed was a transformative encounter. So as I say, I imagine that all of us have had some encounters that have had a really big effect on our lives. And I was thinking, what I'm calling an encounter here, what I'm calling a meeting here, this is just a little bit of an aside, but I thought I'd throw it in. I'm using it in a particular sense, which is, I think it has to be positive, the sense I'm using it, because I think if there's been any sort of diminishment of one person by the other, any sort of even violence in any of its forms of one by the other, then it's not a real meeting in the way that I'm talking about it. I think a real meeting, as I'm using that word, is something that enhances the beings of the people in the encounter. But I was thinking that doesn't always mean that it's pleasant just because it's positive. It can even be a bit devastating having a real encounter, a real meeting. And again, I was thinking that very simple example above that I said about this person saying, "How are you?" It felt very, I felt very taken in and very, taken in the positive sense of that and very met in a positive way. But it was also quite challenging because it made me realise that in my own connections with people, I wasn't giving them that much attention. So it had, in another way, also had a bit of a devastating effect. It sort of shook me up and it made me have to rethink my whole relationships with everybody. So yes, so sometimes a real meeting has this mixture of, it's not always totally pleasant, it's got an element of challenge in it. So anyway, so on this retreat, we're hoping to meet the Buddha. Well, certainly that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping to meet the Buddha in more depth. So another way of putting that, I was thinking, would be to say that I'm trying to discover who the Buddha is on deeper and deeper levels. And to do that, I myself will have to change. I'll have to change to meet the Buddha, and the encounter will change me. Do you see? So both things will be happening at the same time. If I let it, that encounter will change me. I'll have to change to have the encounter, and then the encounter will change me if I let it. So there's a poem I really like. I'm often talking about it, and actually I'm often talking about it at this retreat, for which I make no apology. I do return to it again and again. It's a poem by Ted Hughes, and it's a poem called New Foal. Remarkably enough, this poem, I think you think this is remarkable when you hear a bit of it, it actually belongs in a children's book. Ted Hughes wrote quite a few books for children. And he wrote a book called What is the Truth for Children. It was about life on a farm. And this poem called New Foal is one of these poems in this book. And it starts off kind of ordinarily enough, a kind of bit of a farmyard poem. It starts off with the birth of a foal. The first lines of the poem are rather beautiful, I think. The first lines are, "Yesterday he was nowhere to be found, in the skies or under the skies. Suddenly he's here." Yes, so you've got this foal born. And then he goes on in the poem. The narrative is that the foal literally starts to find its feet. You know, you've got it standing up. You've got it kind of nosing for its mother, sort of experimenting with being able to walk and so on, and experiencing its senses, you know, experiencing the world around it through its senses. So that's the first, it's quite a long poem, got about a page of that sort of description. But then the lines I really like, and that I think are quite incredible, are these lines. So he says, "Soon he'll be almost a horse. He wants only to be horse. Pretending each day more and more horse, till he's perfect horse. Then unearthly horse will surge through him, weightless, a spinning of flame under sudden gusts. It will coil his eyeball and his heel in a single terror, like the awe between lightning and thunderclap. Amazing, isn't it? In this little children's book of the farm, you know. So the rest of my talk's going to be talking about this poem, really, and hopefully about the Buddha. I think, yeah, this poem to me very much speaks of how we encounter the Buddha. So I think in the poem, up until the line, soon he'll be almost a horse. Yeah, as I say, it's a normal sort of nature farmyard poem. A foal becomes a horse. So he's talking about something that happens through time, in ordinary time, and happens in the material world, the world of the senses. And this is the world where we first meet the Buddha. So the Buddha was born in northern India 2,500 years ago, and he was born into a life of privilege. And he was born into a life of protection. He led, so we're told, a protected, sheltered life. And as a result of a very deep questioning, you could even say of existential crisis, at a young age, maybe his late 20s, early 30s, he went forth, he left this life of the palace, the protective, beautiful, but sort of imprisoning world of the palace. And through his sustained effort, he had all sorts of adventures, and we maybe will be hearing more about these over the coming days. But suffice it to say just now, through his sustained effort, his own effort, he attained this state that we call enlightenment, this mysterious state which is always very, very hard to describe in words because it's beyond words. But if I was to try and describe it, I'd say things like it was a state where he had panoramic and perfect wisdom. Yeah, so he wasn't kind of closed down only with a very narrow perspective. He had this panoramic perspective. He had wisdom. Out of this resulted spontaneous compassion. So the Buddha would always be compassionate in all circumstances. This state of enlightenment is a state of boundless energy, boundless positive energy in pursuit of the good. And it's a state of constant creativity, so it's constant responsiveness, always enriching the situation, bringing more into any encounter than had been there before. We'll hear more, we'll have more vivid descriptions of the state we call enlightenment over the next few days. So after that, so he's still only in his early 30s, the Buddha wandered, spent the whole rest of his life until he was in his 80s teaching, by just wandering around teaching whoever he encountered, sometimes one person at a time, sometimes whole groups of people, but just wandering around, you know. And I think, you can tell me later if you disagree with me, but I think it's hard not to be inspired by the example of the Buddha, even if you're not a Buddhist. I think if you read the stories, and as I say, we'll be hearing some, and see all those qualities in action, the courage, the real kindness, the wisdom, the energy, the skill in teaching, you know, to me, these are all, well, human qualities that I imagine most people find inspiring, and most people would like to have more of those qualities. It was funny because I had written this talk before coming on the retreat, and then Janavach and I and some others were sorting out the classrooms upstairs. You know, we were putting the chairs around for the groups, and there's the religious studies room, and it looked like they had a teacher who encouraged them to think for themselves, and they all had to write, the children looked like they'd all had to write post-it notes of different things on the board. Anyway, one of the presumably teenagers had written on their post-it, "Freedom is boring, God is omni-boring." So I thought, maybe everybody wouldn't find freedom inspiring, or then thought, or maybe just clever teenagers don't. So, but I think most people would find that quality of freedom. I still stick by, I think most people would find that quality of freedom inspiring. And what's more, what's the most inspiring thing of all about the Buddha is that the Buddha was born a human being. So the Buddha didn't manifest as some sort of divine incarnation. He was born a human being, just like us. So this is absolutely central to Buddhist teaching. Well, it's got a very strong implication for us, hasn't it? That the Buddha was born and so are we. So the Buddha attained this sort of perfection of the human and even went beyond that. And that means that we can as well. I mean, it sounds simple just saying it, but it's sort of earth-shakingly profound, I think, in its implication that any human being can attain that. It's not, every single person's got the potential for that, given their own effort and the right conditions. So that's central to Buddhist teaching, and I think the most inspiring thing. So, well, when we're relating to the Buddha of history, even being inspired by the Buddha of history, well, that's a kind of meeting. So learning about the Buddha in that way and allowing ourselves to be inspired, if we do find that inspiring, that's a kind of meeting. So that's quite significant. In a way, it's the most simple level we can meet the Buddha, but it's still very significant. I think especially in a world where cynicism can rule, in a world where sometimes we feel we don't want to let ourselves be affected. Who knows, maybe that was what that teenager in the classroom upstairs was feeling. I don't know. So in today's world, I think we're particularly affected by that kind of cynicism. But even at the time of the Buddha, you know, people literally met the Buddha and kind of didn't know who they were meeting. So we've got this telling story that when the Buddha was first enlightened, he decided to go back to some people he previously knew and share that with them. You can imagine it. You know, you've just been like, you think, oh gosh, I want to communicate that. And he was walking along the road, presumably looking very bright and alert, and he bumped into somebody. And this person said to him, as was often the case in India then and even now, you know, you look pretty amazing. Who's your teacher? And the Buddha says, well, you know, I haven't got a teacher. I'm the Buddha. I'm enlightened. And the person just said, oh, fair enough then. And he just went off in the other direction. Yeah. So in a sense, he didn't meet the Buddha. Yes, he bumped into him on the road, but he didn't meet the Buddha. He wasn't affected. So even on this kind of historical, I mean, for us, of course, we're not going to literally meet the historical Buddha, but we can meet him through, reading stories and hearing stories, and if we're inspired, allowing ourselves, to be affected by that. So if we want to meet the Buddha, I mean, we don't have to if we don't want to in a way, but if we want to, then, meeting him on this level is an indispensable part of that. And there's much more to it than that. There's more dimensions. So I'm going to go back to the poem again to hopefully illustrate this. So in the next line of the poem, a change happens. So we've had this narrative, farmyard as it were, narrative. The next line, so we've had soon he'll be almost a horse. The next line is, he wants only to be horse. And here Ted Hughes does two things. He gives horse a capital letter and he takes away the a. So it's not he wants only to be a horse with a small letter. It's he wants only to be horse. So he's using horse, I think, in a special way here. For want of a better word, you could say an archetypal way, an ideal way. So he's idealised horse. It's in capitals. So where does this ideal horse exist? No longer in the farmyard, basically, or in any realm of the senses. So that the ideal horse, horse with a capital H, only exists in the imaginal realm, in the heightened realm of refined imagination. That's the only place we can meet an archetypal form. And this is where the ideal Buddha exists as well. So when we see images or pictures of the Buddha, most of the time, and probably 99.9% of the time, the images and pictures we see are trying to depict this realm. You know, so on the shrine here, we've got the Buddha, golden, sitting on golden cloth, bejeweled. That's not the Buddha of history. You know, the Buddha of history is going to be like a skinny 80-year-old person, you know, Indian person. This is the Buddha of the imaginal realm, the archetypal. I'm kind of hesitating using that word. I'm hesitant because I don't mean archetypal in the Jungian sense, but I can't quite think of a better word just now. The realm of the imaginal. So just to be clear, when I say imaginal, I don't kind of mean made up in a sort of like a fantasy or something like that. I mean something just as real, even more real than the world of our senses. And it's a bit harder to talk about this and maybe a little bit harder to think of examples in our own life, although we may have examples of this kind of meeting in our own life. And I'm going to give you an example. It's not my own. It's a friend of mine told me about this. She said that she went to see a Buddhist teacher living in India. His name was Dardo Rinpoche. He's dying now, but very, very revered teacher. And she went to see him when he was an old man. And they had this very animated conversation. And somebody must have taken photographs of the conversation. And when she came back home, this is what she said. She said she looked at the photographs and she was really surprised and even a bit shocked because she saw in the photograph a picture of herself talking to an old man. But actually her experience of the encounter had been totally different. She'd experienced herself talking to a sort of radiant being. So she could hardly, I mean, she could probably see it was the same person, but there was a sort of shift. There was a shift in what she saw in the photograph, the literal image, and what it had been like actually in her experience. So which was the more real, you know, which was the more real? So we can ask ourselves, is that something in my own experience? Have I had that kind of experience? And in the Buddhist tradition, these forms in the imaginal realm would have appeared in the hearts and minds of the disciples of the Buddha as they meditated on him after he had passed away. So after the Buddha had died, these people would have been with him during his life. They'd have known, they'd have seen at first hand all his qualities and so on, and they'd have been meditating on the Buddha. They'd have been remembering him, but in a special way, remember him in a special way, really reflecting on his qualities. And the tradition says that spontaneously these like very beautiful forms like this kind of form would arise in their minds. They'd see forms of all different colours as if the qualities were personified. So they'd see different colours, different gestures, but always beautiful and energetic and bejeweled, and always associated with different qualities of the Buddha. And again, we're going to be, this is just a little me flagging up what we're going to be hearing about in detail over the next number of evenings. We're going to be meeting and we're hearing about and hopefully meeting these archetypal forms. And just, you know, to say it's not that they were made up, you know, they weren't thought up. It was something much more spontaneous and much more for much greater depths than that. So they're connected. So the Buddha of history and the Buddha of the imaginal realm are totally connected with each other. It was through reflecting on the Buddha's actual qualities that these archetypal forms that we see depicted appeared. Yes. Yeah, it's like we gain access to one through the other. We gain access to the Buddha of the imaginal realm through the Buddha of the historical realm. And as I say, this is a large part of what this retreat is going to be about. But I want to go back to the poem again, and still the same line. So this line, there's a lot in this line, I think. He wants only to be hoarse. So he wants only. So that's quite strong, isn't it? That's all he wants. The entirety of his longing. So I think that's very significant as well. Everything's significant tonight, but yeah. So when the Buddha became enlightened, he had a vision of all humanity like a giant pool of lotuses. And most of the lotuses were still down in the mud. That's where lotuses come from, isn't it? Here and there, some had risen up from the mud, and here and there, some were fully open. Some were buds, but occasionally some were fully opened in this vision, fully open and spotless. As soon as a lotus opens, the mud all can't stick to it anymore, so they're spotless. This vision is a bit of a similar image to a foal and a horse, something grows into its fullness, yeah? So in this vision, what the Buddha was seeing, that all human consciousness contains within it the seeds of its own transcendence. So from the standpoint of the Buddha, from the standpoint of the enlightened mind, if as it were the Buddha was kind of watching us, what he would see was most of us groping around in the mud, trying to make ourselves happy with things that can never really make us happy. They might give us temporary satisfaction, but they can never really make us happy. And that's where the Buddha's compassion comes from. Imagine if you're the Buddha, you think, oh, what a pity, you know, what a pity. They're trying to do something, they're trying to do the impossible. The Buddha would look at us and try to see us trying to do the impossible. To make ourselves happy with things that just can't. And the reason they can't has got a number of levels of it. It's not just because everything's impermanent. Buddhism makes quite a lot of this truth of impermanence. So we know intellectually that everything doesn't last. Nothing lasts. Nothing material lasts. No person lasts. No relationship lasts. And Buddhism asks us to deeply reflect on that. Again, to try and get us to stop putting our whole hopes and reliances on things that can't satisfy us, yeah? It's not even just because things are impermanent that they can't give us this true satisfaction. It's because, and well, this is what the Buddha would say, so you can see whether you agree with this or not. So the Buddha would say that there's something in all of us that cannot be satisfied until we reach our highest potential. And that highest potential is enlightenment. So that's what the Buddha would say. There's something in all of us that can't be satisfied, no matter how much kind of gain we've got, no matter how much we get the world to go as we want, if we even manage to do that. We can't be satisfied until we reach our highest potential. And the Buddha wants us to discover that in ourselves. As I say, that's what the Buddha's compassion consists of. That's what all the Buddha's teachings are about. Just to make it clear, the Buddha isn't saying when he sees us all down in this mud, he doesn't see us as bad. The Buddha doesn't really have any kind of truck with that kind of good bad thing. He sees, oh, they're confused. You know, he would see us as confused, and Yeah, so the Buddha says somewhere we know we can be that horse, that lotus. But the trouble is that we don't, most of the time, we don't even allow ourselves to feel that sense of that there's something missing. We try and cover it up, or other people try to jolly us along. And maybe some of us have had that experience. But from a Buddhist point of view, that something missing feeling, if we encounter it, is something to cherish. From a Buddhist point of view, the first step is to cherish that dissatisfaction. So I was had a lovely letter from a young woman the other day, and she was talking about her excitement at finding Buddhism. And she had had a memory of when she was a little girl, and she was, and her memory was she saw this book on the window of a shop. And this book, I can't remember the title of it, but it promised to tell the history of everything. And she was so excited she managed to convince her parents to buy the book, even though it wasn't even her birthday or anything. And she was so fascinated by it, she read it all in one sitting. And she said it was very fascinating. It was the whole history of the world. But what she remembered, and this is what she said when she'd finished, she said she had a confused feeling of disappointment. And then she was just a little girl. She said, so now I knew everything. And it had to be everything, otherwise the book would have mentioned it. But deep inside, she said, I'd been left just the same. She said, I still did not really know. And when she wrote that word, she gave it a capital letter. She still did not really know. And she felt there had to be something else. Yeah. That was what she felt when she was a little girl, but people didn't, you know, she said she went through her life and people didn't really understand her and they tried to cheer her up and stuff, and it was only when she came along to Buddhism she relaxed because she was allowed to feel that feeling of there had to be something else. So yeah, so that confused feeling of disappointment. If we feel it, Buddhism says don't try and get away from it, try and go deeper into it, stay with it. Buddhism always starts with an experience of dissatisfaction. Of dissatisfaction with life just lived in an endless circle of birth and death and a bit of pleasure here and a bit of pain there. That's how it was for the Buddha. That was what got him to leave home. The Buddha wasn't a philosopher. He didn't sort of sit down one day and say, oh, think up this new religion and call it Buddhism. It was an actual existential deep experience, a felt sense that compelled him to go on this search. So when I say that Buddhism starts with an experience of dissatisfaction, I wonder if you all feel, oh my God, you know, Buddhism's all going to be about doom and gloom. But it's not that either. So it's not that if you're a Buddhist, you're going round glumly kind of thinking, oh God, this is awful, it's all dissatisfaction. I'm glad you laughed, that's good. So here's a lovely thing that the Buddha himself says that I think kind of really helped me to see that. The Buddha himself said, he said, like certain recluses and Brahmins have been going around telling lies about me. They've said that Gotama, the recluse, that's the Buddha, and all his followers have gone astray. For Gotama, the recluse, teaches when one reaches up to the release called the beautiful, and having reached it and abides therein, at such a time he regards the whole universe as ugly. But then the Buddha says, I never said that. The Buddha says, but I never said that. This is what I do say. Whenever one reaches up to the release called the beautiful, then he knows indeed what beauty is. Yeah, so that's, do you see the difference? Yeah, so it's not saying that the whole world is rubbish and ugly. But the Buddha said, oh, but compared to what I've seen, don't be satisfied with less. Don't be satisfied with this. Look, you could all be here too. You know, that's what the Buddha's saying to us. Um, pretending each day more and more horse. That's what the fool's doing. He's longing to be horse, pretending each day more and more horse. So pretend, it's got sort of different meanings, hasn't it? Here it means to make believe or to act as if. And this is also connected with Buddhism. So central to Buddhism is the notion that how we act modifies our consciousness. So when I was a little girl, I was a very, very devout Catholic. I was absolutely sincere. I used to go to Mass every single day, even though my parents didn't. You know, my parents made us go to Mass on Sunday, but I wasn't content with it. Every single day I was at Mass, and I used to go to confession every single week, and I used to even get the priest to say special confessions just for me, because I sometimes, thinking back, I see the priest like thinking, oh God, it's her again. But I was absolutely, I was so devout. And what my teacher, and I don't know if all teachers were like this, but my teacher, we got taught a lot about religion in school in a particular way, which I now would say was a bit literalistic. So what my teacher, Mrs. Grimley, told us was, at the age of six, you had this soul, it was white, but then every time you sinned, an ink blot went on your stainless white soul, right, and blotted it all with ink. But then you could go to confession, you see, and all the ink blots would be cleaned off. But then they would just come back again. So your best hope, well, this is what I believed, obviously took it literally as well, was that your best hope would be to die the minute you'd just been to confession before you had time to do it. I get another blow. Honestly, I believe this, you know. And probably many people still do, actually. So what I was reflecting on recently is I had absolutely no notion that going to the kind of confessing my sins could actually change me in any way. I never thought that, I had no sense of that I could be modified in any way by this practice of going to confession. It wasn't a practice in the way I would call spiritual practice now. It was just a kind of thing I did, and this desperate hope that, you know, I would manage to die without any more ink blots, you know. And eventually, of course, as I got older, I did like too many sins, you know, and I couldn't keep up, you know, so I had to just give the whole thing up. So but you see what I mean? I thought that's entirely different from the notion of practicing ethics. So that was the kind of Catholic ethics, as it were, as I understood it. I admit that I was a bit literal about it. But that's entirely different from the notion of yourself being changed by your practice. Buddhism just hasn't got that notion of staining, because, you know, it hasn't even got a soul to stain in the first place. You haven't got the staining because you haven't got the soul. You've got something much more subtle, I think, in Buddhism. You may disagree with me, which is fine. My own teacher, Sangharakshita, gives voice to how Buddhism sees us with this analogy, which again I make no apologies for saying many times here on this retreat, because I think it's really good. He gives an analogy of the poet and the poem. So he says, so a poet is presumably inspired, and then they write a poem from that inspiration. And then we might not be inspired, but we read the poem, and then we are raised up by that. Yeah. And then so our consciousness is transformed. And so instead of the notion of sin and souls and ink blots and things, Buddhism says, so what, how a Buddha would naturally act would be kind, would be generous, would be wise. The Buddha's like the poet, so the Buddha's not trying to do that. That's just flowing out of the Buddha's inspiration. We are not the Buddha, but if we act like that, that's like reading the poem, and that will raise us up. So that will modify our consciousness. We'll be changed by acting like that. Yeah? So, and then we can start to create a positive spiral. Yeah, because the more we're changed, then the more likely we are to act in that way more naturally ourselves and so on. Do you see what I mean? Do you sort of see the difference in the model? You can always ask your group leader as well tomorrow. So, and what's more, Buddhism saying that when we practice like this, when we act more like a Buddha, an enlightened being would naturally act, our consciousness is modified not just in a random way, but in the direction of the Buddha. And this is what we call the practice of ethics in Buddhism. So many, many people, of course, religious and not religious, practice ethics. But for a Buddhist, it's practicing in this particular way to move closer and closer to encountering the Buddha, like I've just hopefully managed to describe. And the Buddha, his practice of ethics is perfect because it isn't a practice at all. It's not something self-consciously done. So practice is something that I've got to do, but for the Buddha it's not like that. The Buddha's compassion has no trace of an I in it. There's no sense of this is me doing this kind thing for the Buddha. For us, we've still got that self-consciousness. So we've got to have that I am practicing, and we try as much as we can to let go of the self-consciousness. But for a Buddha, the Buddha's life is a life beyond self-clinging. There isn't that sense of I in it. So in fact, you can only really meet the Buddha if you've got a mind that's fit to meet the Buddha. If you have modified your being through this kind of action, this skillful action like I've described, then that's the only way you can meet the Buddha. Yeah, so you're doing it in order to meet the Buddha, and that's the only way you can meet the Buddha. So both are happening at the same time. And that's what's distinctive and particular about the Buddhist practice of what we call ethics compared to being kind. You know, there's lots of ways of being kind, but this is the particular way of being of. Yeah, this is what's particular to the Buddhist practice of that. And it's very different from being good. So I was thinking, the Buddha's not like Santa Claus, who only comes to good children. You don't meet the Buddha as a kind of reward for good action. Nor do you not meet him as a sort of punishment for not good action. It's much more, to my mind, much more subtle and, in a way, asks of us more of our intelligence than that. Again, I'll just tell you something Sangharakshita says. He says, if you're not ethical, you won't meet the Buddha. He says, you may read books on Buddhism, that won't get you to meet the Buddha. You may meet other Buddhists, that won't get you to meet the Buddha. You may hear talks on Buddhism, that won't get you to meet the Buddha. But he says that doesn't mean you can only meet the Buddha if you're a good person. It's something very different from that. In fact, he says the good person probably won't meet the Buddha. So that's interesting, isn't it? You're not going to meet the Buddha by being good in a sort of I'm being good sort of way. And Sangharakshita says the good person is usually just conforming. Yeah, so if we're just kind of being good out of kind of fear of punishment and so on, that's not what we're calling ethics in the Buddhist sense. Elsewhere, actually, Sangharakshita says the only dead Buddhist is a good one. Yeah. The only dead Buddhist is a good one. No, the only dead Buddhist is a good one. Nobody laughs. The only dead Buddhist is a good one.
We'll think about that in groups.
We'll think about that in groups, yeah. So what he's saying is, if you're good, you're a dead Buddhist, yeah? If you're good, you're dead as a Buddhist. Which doesn't mean to say that if you're... Did you get it? Oh, that's quite funny. Anyway, I better move on. I must say, yeah, before I move on, though, I must say I'm very interested in this distinction between skillful and good. I do talk about it in your groups, because I do think this notion of good and bad comes from a literalization of what in Buddhism is called skillful and unskillful. Skillful action in Buddhism is action that's based, well, that is the way a Buddha would naturally act. It's based in love and generosity and wisdom. So you could say that any true religion, I think, starts with some kind of apprehension of some spiritual truth. And that eventually has to be expressed in some sort of doctrine, some that has to be given form as teachings. And in the case of Buddhism, the whole purpose of its doctrines and teachings are to direct us back to that apprehension. But what we've got to constantly do is watch that we're not taking the doctrines as fixed truths. That's where it goes wrong. That's where we become the dead Buddhist or the dead whatever it is we're trying to practice. And it's the same with these images of the Buddha and the archetypal forms. They're a gateway. Yeah, so they're not literally true. The Buddha didn't literally look like this. And we need to be alert to that. Because I think we all do, well, certainly I do, but I'm sure we all do have a tendency to literalise. We want to fix things. And I think that's because living with the mystery is challenging. I think all too easily we solidify the forms that religion takes. We solidify doctrines, we solidify rituals, institutions, etc. We make them ends in themselves instead of means to an end. And, you know, I think that's what puts us off the spiritual life often, because as soon as we do this, religion becomes something that imprisons us rather than frees us. And I think Buddhism is particularly aware of this tendency. It's constantly critiquing itself. It's constantly saying of itself that it's only a means to an end. It's not sacred in itself. It's not... We haven't... In Buddhism, we haven't got these notions of blasphemy and so on. There's no sort of sense that you would want to persecute or in other ways punish somebody that said anything against the doctrines, because they're not sacred, they're only a means. There's this lovely analogy in Buddhism of they're a raft, you know, you use them to get to the other shore, but then you don't put the raft on your head and start carrying it around with you. They're a means to an end. So our foal is pretending each day more and more horse till he's perfect horse. So till he's perfect horse. So that sounds good, doesn't it? Perfect horse. And it is good up to a point, yeah? It's good up to a point because there's a danger that confronts every true spiritual practitioner, not just Buddhist, I think. So you could say that the first concern, or the really ultimate concern of spiritual practice is to become a happy, healthy human being. So that's what we want to do first of all. And we can do that in Buddhism through the mindfulness of breathing, through the metta bhavana, other practices, the communication exercises we do here and so on. But that's not the end. You know, that's not the end point. We're not trying just to be a happy, healthy human being, integrated, positive and so on, although that's necessary. Well, and desirable, isn't it? But the real point is to move beyond self-clinging completely. Not because self-clinging is bad, as I said, but because there's a danger, because it's imprisoning, not because it's bad, but because it's imprisoning. And there's a danger that our practice, that any spiritual practice, can just create a more refined sense of ourself. So we've not actually gone beyond ourself. We've just created a kind of nicer, happier self that finds it maybe a bit easier to live in the world. That's fine, but real spiritual practice would say, no, there's more than that. We're still imprisoned if we stop there. But the problem is, what can you do? What can you do to go beyond that? And in a sense, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing an individual can do. I think all you can do, and this is again what Buddhism would say, is all you can do is open yourself to the influence of something that transcends your normal experience of yourself. All you can do is open yourself up to something that is, as it were, bigger than you and is, as it were, outside yourself. Then unearthly horse will surge through him. Yeah, so that's the poem. Then unearthly horse will surge through him. So Buddhism says that there is a reality beyond self-clinging that reaches down to us, as it were. And I think other religions would say that too. Theistic religions would say that too. But perhaps the theistic religions wouldn't say the "as it were" that I'm carefully saying here. Because where Buddhism is, I think, distinctive in that it says that this something that seems to be reaching down is not some eternal God or any other abiding essence. That we can connect, if we want to, with something mysterious, something awe-inspiring and supremely desirable, something that will change us in the encounter. But that something is in inverted commas. That something isn't something that has an unchanging essence anywhere at all, inside or outside, which is impossible to understand with our ordinary mind. We can't, nobody can understand that with our ordinary mind. We can only understand that, or only, not even understand isn't quite the right word, we can only apprehend that in a mind that's been raised to a higher state through meditation. Yeah, well, that's what Buddhism would say. Because it doesn't make sense to our ordinary minds going, well, is it something or is it nothing? Is it inside or outside? We don't know how to say it's neither, it's both, you know. That's all our ordinary mind will do will be to ask that question. That's all it can do. We can't answer it with our ordinary mind. And that's why we can only meet the Buddha through practicing in some of the ways I've been talking about. We've got to make our mind fit to even start to begin to understand what it might mean to meet the Buddha. And we can't make that happen. That surging through us, that unearthly surging through us, isn't something we can make happen through willed effort. All we can do is set up the conditions through these practices. And all we can do, as well as that, we can work on our capacity for receptivity, which we've all got faculty for. That's integral to being human. Buddhism would certainly say that. That we've all got this faculty for receptivity. It's part of our consciousness as human beings to be able to respond to value and to be able to respond to qualities. But often it's obscured by other strands of our being. It's obscured by our instincts and other emotions, our likes and dislikes. And it's, as well as being obscured, it's often dulled. We dull it through cynicism, we dull it through long association with people who don't value, yeah, or who've also allowed it to become dulled in them, yeah. So what we've got to do if we want this to happen is consciously allow ourselves to respond to value and to notice when we have. So to allow ourselves to respond to when someone does something selfless or very courageous. To allow ourselves to respond when someone brings in a bigger perspective, not to just sort of stubbornly stick to, I'm right, you know, and I won't allow this in. To allow ourselves to respond to beauty. So this, and then if we do that, then that brings me on to the last bit, again from the poem. Then unearthly horse will surge through him, weightless, a spinning of flame under sudden gusts. It will coil his eyeball and his heel in a single terror, like the awe between lightning and thunderclap. The awe between lightning and thunderclap. You get a sense of that, don't you? When I say it, I get a sense of that, that awe between lightning and thunderclap. And that's there in potential all the time. That's that living in that sense of awe between lightning and thunderclap is something we could do all the time. You could say that spiritual life is to live from that moment. It's mysterious, isn't it? It's the moment when, if it's not too fanciful, grace can descend. It's something outside our usual notion of exchange. You know, I'll do this and I'll get something back. I'll meditate, I'll feel more calm. It's something of a different order than that. And we can easily miss it. I think especially in this age where we tend to fill every single gap, you know. We fill, you know, train journeys. That used to be a time where you looked out the window, didn't it, in a sort of reverie. Now everybody works on the train, nearly everyone. I'm delighted to hear people have handed in their mobile phones, actually, because I think that sense of being constantly available and constantly, you know, that we're constantly doing something. I remember I met a young woman here on retreat once who had handed in her mobile phone. And she said that what she noticed was when she was having a conversation with somebody, even if there was the slightest gap, her body made this gesture to go for her phone to text, to check her text, yeah? Because she couldn't, she realised that she couldn't bear that gap, even momentarily in conversation. She had to fill it. So it was, you know, in a way it was great. She was rejoicing in the fact she noticed that. So yes, think especially when I think of this, I was thinking the awe between lightning and thunderclap. I was thinking these days we'd probably be, you know, texting somebody to tell them about the lightning before we'd even heard the thunderclap, as it were. So I want to encourage us, especially on this retreat, to try and live in that moment. I think especially on retreat, we can allow ourselves to start to practice living in those gaps. I think for me on retreat, a particular moment where that can be heightened is, you know, when the final bell goes at the end of meditation. I always think that's kind of one of those moments. It's a special kind of silence. If you can just let go into it. I always think that's a moment where grace can descend. And I wanted to say, don't miss it. Don't miss that moment. I wanted to say to everyone, just at that moment at the end of a meditation or at the end of a ritual, don't be the first to move, you know. Just sit in that moment and just see, you know. Don't try and make anything happen, but just notice. We can't make it happen. We can't drag the lightning down from the sky, but we can build a lightning conductor through our efforts here, and then we can just wait and not miss it. So I thought to finish, I'll just read you the last little bit of the poem, and the few lines I've read, but then the last bit of the whole poem. Then unearthly horse... excuse me. Then unearthly horse will surge through him, weightless, a spinning of flame under sudden gusts. It will coil his eyeball and his heel in a single terror, like the awe between lightning and thunderclap, and curve his neck like a sea monster emerging among foam, and fling the new moons through his stormy banner, and the full moons, and the dark moons. Thank you.